Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and with me once again this week, it's the Cincinnati kid himself, Brian.
How you doing, Brian?
Good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing fine. You laughing at the Cincinnati kid reference?
I always appreciate that you do it cold, and I don't know what it is, so I figure out the connection when you're done, but it's always an amusing time to wait and see what it'll be.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's on one hand, it's probably easier because I'm used to doing it between both Dan and myself, where it's, you know, doing that little compare and contrasting that I've done probably a couple hundred times over the last few years. But when it's you, I try to make it very specific to what I know about you. And what do I know about Brian? He's a lawyer guy, and he's in Kentucky, and he likes the Reds, and he likes his whiskey, and he's and he's a swell fella. Anyway.
That's a Greg, what a great biography. I think you've got me nailed.
Oh, so what, you know, what if you should pass before me, I'll give like a really quick eulogy, but the opposite of my podcast. It'll be over just like that. Anyway. Wow, we're getting our meandering rambling done at the beginning instead of the end of this podcast tonight. We are actually here to be talking about Legion, and we are now up to what chapter? We are up to chapter 25. It's amazing with Noah Hawley, he's so original and fascinating with his titles of his Fargo episodes. He really kind of phones in with Legion when he just has them called chapters. Anyway, I'm just kidding. Speaking of that, it's kind of interesting to note that this is the first episode of the entire season that was written solely by Noah Hawley. He's always had a creative by credit on the writing side for all the episodes this season so far. He actually didn't write either co-write either the last two episodes, and all the other ones he was a co-writer on. But this one is all Hawley, no one else.
Yeah, I thought that was I noticed that, and I also noticed as we talk about the episode, the sort of Legion intro was really placed in an interesting place in this episode.
Oh yeah, I mean it's kind of a funny thing. I feel there's been a few shows that from time to time get cute with when they actually give us the opening credit. I think Legion has done that before. And I think there's been a few other shows that have done that over the last couple years. Of course, none of them come to mind immediately. I feel like one of them, it might have been like Mr. Robot or something like that. Or There was even an episode of The Good Wife that they waited till like 20-something minutes into the episode before they actually popped it in there. It was kind of out of nowhere. But yeah, this one came pretty late in the episode, if I remember, which really kind of segments the first section of the episode as being something other than Legion, quite frankly.
Right.
Which it certainly felt like. Oh, which I guess then leads to what I guess we can call my brief summation. Hey, that's words lawyers like you like to use, brief summation.
Mm-hmm.
A brief summation. Anyway, let me break it down so we can get talking about this. As I was just saying, most of this episode is really, I would say it's a journey to the astral plane with Sid. We essentially watch her grow up and be cared for by a loving couple that means the world to her, but it's not her parents. It's actually Melanie and Oliver Bird. Yay! Over the course of time, we see that Sid learns life lessons about the nature of things like good and evil and empathy and maybe other less weighty matters in this literally a flower box fantasy plane that they're in, while a somewhat literal wolf always is lurking at the door. We do eventually return to, you know, air quote time, reality, or at least the Legion version of reality, and they're still aboard that zebra-striped aircraft, and Sid bands together with Carrie and Carrie Loudermilk to find a way to make like switch and take a stroll down that time-traveling hallway in order to stop David, yada, yada, yada. So that's the really quickie version of what this episode was about. Obviously, I left out all the details for you to plunge yourself into and make with the fairy tale telling of this story. I don't know if it's a fairy tale or a fable or a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's you know, it's funny that, because I already referenced Fargo, so I'll do at least one more reference right now. There was an episode of Fargo in season 3 where they used the actual recording for Peter and the Wolf.
I remember that. Yeah.
Which I also remembered as a kid growing up, where it's being narrated, and you know, we're introduced to different characters that are each represented by different instruments in the orchestra, so on and so forth, and they're telling this story, which is basically like, I don't remember if Peter the Wolf is, it's kind of like a, it's not Hans Christian Andersen, but something like that, you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that now we get this, which feels like it almost should have been part of that. You know, it's almost like they were like, you know, cousins to each other. Anyway, I will stop because if I go any further, I'll be rambling even worse. This is what lack of sleep does to a person, and let you take over with your views on this one.
I'll probably surprise you. I enjoyed it. I loved seeing Melanie and Oliver. But the thing that stuck with me is I wish maybe they'd got someone other than Mantzoukas to play the Wolf, because I don't know if he's been so iconic as like Dennis Feinberg on Parks and Rec or whatever, but he's always such a comical character, and there's certainly play for some humor. But really the only menace was sort of his dark look and his growl and his sort of, you know, creepiness with Cynthia. And not that he was bad, and he's a great actor, but I didn't love him as the Wolf. I didn't find him menacing enough, and perhaps because it's a fairy tale, that's okay. But I loved seeing the birds back, and seeing sort of the baby in the basket, you know, raise the baby as your own. Mm-hmm. Tale, and the darkness intruding on the fairy tale world. It was a nice story. And I really thought in particular what I enjoyed was this was maybe the most, until the just absolute batshit crazy rap battle, this was maybe the most grounded that Oliver has ever been. And seeing Jemaine Clement play very straight and earnest and sincere, and seeing Melanie not smoking, you know, from the hookah and acting out of her head, seeing them just be very earnest and sincere with this child, I really liked that part of it. I thought it was very sweet, and we got to see those actors without some of the bigger stuff that has been a part of their character. And so although it was a fantasy, they were like a more muted version of themselves than we saw in the quote unquote real world. And I enjoyed that.
That's a lot to unpack there. I'm probably going to mildly disagree with you about the casting of the Wolf. Only because I understand what you're saying about him, you know, because he has such, the actor Mantzoukas has such a comical presence from, that's what he's been known for. You mentioned 30 Rock, which I had actually forgotten about. To me, he's just another FX alumni that they got, because he plays a recurring character on the show The League for several years. And I think Noah Hawley likes bringing in people from FX comedies, like he did with the guy who plays Dennis, you know, in season 1 of Fargo. Actors who weren't not known for dramatic acting necessarily.
He loves comedians, there's no doubt.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, some of the people we're seeing, I mean, Jermaine Clement is not known as a dramatic actor either. I mean, obviously he does play it very comically at times. Bill Irwin is a clown, quite frankly. I think I like that he went in that direction with the Wolf character, because it made it, not that anything was really playing like cliched here to begin with, because, you know, this kind of like this little fable-y fairy tale world was kind of out, came out of nowhere. Even though I guess one could say they were kind of hinting at a certain kind of storybook feel this season with like the with the Alice in Wonderland kind of hints and stuff like that. I think I liked it more because, yeah, there was something kind of comical about it. I mean, some of it was played directly for laughs, especially the, especially when you get reminding them not to forget about chlamydia. I just think it made it more memorable to me. I think we already dipped into the horror realm already with those Time Eaters, who we then revisited the show at towards the end of the episode. So I didn't need to go that route with it. So I just like the fact that it kind of reminded me of, you know, it's almost like a little stage production of, say, like Little Red Riding Hood or something like that, where it would just be an actor playing the wolf. And there was some, at times, a little goofy, but there was something kind of coolly insidious about him. So so I just liked it just because it was different. But, you know, to each their own. Question, though. So, that's kind of a big question. So this world, now, they're on the, this is supposedly the astral plane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the construct that we're seeing, and what happens towards the end where they become, they look more like themselves again. They're back, they're dressed more in their, you know, their normal outfits and hair and whatever. Was this all a construct that was made for Sid? Did Sid create this herself without knowing it? Did they create it for her? You know what I'm trying to say? I'm trying to figure out how that, because that's, I mean, I didn't read a bunch of articles about the episode, and so I didn't like try to take the temperature of different critics and reviewers or anything. But my impression was towards the end that they did this for her. But I could be totally wrong about that.
No, I felt the same, because that when they change, it's their purpose was to prepare her, and they actually say, like, no, you need to go. They had talked about, should she go? When will she go? You know, it's bad out there. Why would she want to go? And they actually get to the point of saying, you're ready. You should go. So I think this was a place. And if you think about it, that it's described in the episode as a place where things that go that get lost. Mm. Hence finding, you know, sort of the joke, like that they find, Oliver says he finds socks, you know, the classic, you know, throw your socks in there, you're always missing a sock. And so I sort of thought of it as all of them somehow lost their way. And even if you want to take it meta, the idea of the big bad wolf in a fairy tale is almost something that in our culture now is lost, that there is sort of a loss of the naivete of the storytelling of a fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
That we're a much more cynical, realistic, hyper-realistic culture and world of storytelling. So I thought that sort of sandbox of what this world was built up to be was that, and they were there for her because they prepare her and send her off and then appear as they were.
Right. So therefore, again, because I didn't rewatch all of season two, unfortunately. And I really wish I had, because I think I'm only, last I checked, I think I had only gotten like halfway through it. Someone else I know is trying to catch up on Legion, so I've been watching with them when I've had the opportunity. And I think we left off on episode 4 or 5 in that season. So basically, I'm just reaching into my memory, which has become fuzzier as I've gotten older. So when we left Oliver and Melanie, were they in a situation where were they on the astral plane? Were they like living in his ice cube at that point or something? Because I got confused, because at one point I thought, wait, did Oliver die? Or did something happen where they're just in another plane of existence from this point on? I don't remember, so I apologize. I'm a bad Legion podcaster. I'm forgetting something key from season two, but I'd rather just be honest about it and ask, and maybe you might remember.
I don't remember in particular, but Melanie's separation from Oliver is when she got loopy with the hookah.
Yes, that much I do remember. And then she became a tool of Farouk towards the end of the season when she was like, you know, putting all those thoughts into Sydney's head and all that kind of stuff. I remember that.
Right. I don't think it was. If it was clarified, I don't remember. But her wanting to be with Oliver in sort of his world, because in bringing him out, bad things had happened. I think it makes sense that there would be a construct where they would be together in the type of world like that his ice, you know, ice right. cube was.
All right. Well, I mean, hopefully maybe between now and when we watch the next episode, I can just fast forward myself and just watch like the final episode of season two again, just to refresh my memory. Even though from the way they were speaking, I don't think the birds are going to appear again in the season. I think that this is a one and done for them. I don't know if they're cast to be in any other episodes. I don't think they are. Although if this whole show is ending, maybe they will show up again. Who knows? Not if the show is ending.
No, this was their have fun storm in the castle moment.
Yes, absolutely. So it's interesting. So this all take, although she ends up living I wouldn't say a lifetime. She ends up living, you know, at least, you know, 20 to 30 years there, so to speak, but it all happens in the space of 20 minutes. I love that kind of stuff, by the way. I always get a kick out of that. And again, we were just talking, I don't remember how it came up, but I brought up something similar to this when I talked about like that Star Trek Next Generation episode of Picard, where he ends up living an entire lifetime in the space of just, you know, just a moment as far as everyone else could see, but he actually lived like an entire lifetime in this other existence somewhere. And that's kind of what Sydney just did. You know, even though it's her own life, but it was a different life, obviously, because she didn't grow up living in this weird little fairy tale world. And then like a Bowery Boys version of New York City or something from horror. Mm-hmm. Actually, looked a little Gangs of New York-ish, actually.
That's exactly what I thought was Gangs of New York.
Or any of those really great shows that came on, you know, in the last, you know, 10 years, like Copper or Ripper Street or all that kind of, you know, had that alienist kind of feeling to it. And that's actually where I thought they did a more interesting job with the Wolf character by just having, because it wasn't so much the portrayal, it's just like having a figure in the background or looking mm-hmm. down that alleyway. There was something really nice and just creepy about it. And of course, having, you know, children offering you different flavors of vodka. So one of the odd or interesting things about this whole little self-contained story for Sydney's character is the Cynthia character. And I guess, in a way, if the point of her being here was for the birds to help her discover what it is she has to do, Cynthia, in a sense, becomes little more than a teaching tool. You know, she in a way she kind of represents, in a weird way, she kind of represents David to a certain extent, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes,
sort of. You could stretch it to that. I mean, only in the sense that, I mean, they're one of the major points they make during the course of this thing is because, you know, Cynthia ends up making the decision to go toward, you know, go with the Wolf, i.e. go towards the dark side, you know, whatever. And Sid wants to try to help her, to rescue, to take her away from, but she ultimately doesn't want to go. And this is the path she's chosen, this is what she wants to do. And maybe the point is, you can't rescue someone who doesn't believe that they need rescuing, you know, that's... Therefore, because sometimes the good guys actually lose, that seems to be a direct parallel to what's going on with David. Because he doesn't see himself as someone who needs rescuing right now. He sees himself as he's the one who's going to fix things. Meanwhile, Sydney now is saying that she's the one who's going to fix things, you know.
Well, I thought her character, Cynthia's character, is both, it's in a way it's David, and in another way it's Sid.
Yeah.
That it's both sides of their relationship, in that there are people that don't need help and want to do what they're going to do, even if it's self-destructive. And then there are also people that don't need to be paternally controlled and can choose their own destiny. And, you know, the sides of Cynthia are both those, and those are both aspects of Sid and David. And, you know, it was sort of, if Sid can learn that she does have what it takes and what she thinks is enough, and her feelings are enough to justify her actions, and she can act on those, and that gives her agency, that's a good lesson from that, as well as that if, you know, David doesn't want to be saved, she can't save him.
Right. And I think one of the things they're also showing with all this is one of the stark differences between, say, Sydney and where she is now, and what, and although I think she had this quality already, but what this astral plane adventure does is really hammer home the need for empathy and to, you know, and understanding, and that's something that David sorely lacks now. And as we've seen, just before this season, but especially now, as far whether it be what Lenny was going through, everything, what he did to Sid and her speaking to him, and you know, even people pleading for their lives, you know, and he still does horrible things to people who have done nothing to him. He has become much more of a sociopath in that sense. And it's really kind of reinforcing, because they keep doing things with Sid here, which are really reinforcing that she is, you know, she is the light. She is fighting on the good side. I mean, she's even told during the episode, I think, that I think Millie makes the distinction, you know, it's not us or them, it's us and them. You know, because, you know, at the end of the day, you're still trying to, you know, save the world, not rip it apart, I guess. If that makes any sense.
Right. And I think another interesting point that with if you think the show needed to course correct from the last season, from the, in essence, rape of Sydney's mind, it's also a point that Sid seeing this and learning that this woman, Cynthia, you know, the rap battle is about two guys, about who gets to control the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman says, like, neither I pick. And so I think there's the take that there's agency in it. And hopefully Sid's story is Sid takes the agency to do what she wants going forward. And I thought to that point, when we jump back to the story that we'd paused for this aside, she's very much more in control.
Yeah.
And she's the one, and I think you asked a couple of episodes ago, who's in control, you know, of Division Three.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when Sid gets back, she's the leader. She's in control. Yeah. And you see that. So she also got that. She got the lesson, which is to be strong, but even being strong, you have to have empathy, and it's us and them. And I thought that line was really good. And then to drive that point home, the us and them, it's not us or them, is then physically manifested in what happens with Carrie and Carrie.
That's the other thing I thought, beyond the life lessons for Sydney, the other significant thing in the episode beyond the actual propulsion of the plot of what they're doing is what happens with the Loudermilks, and probably the greatest bond we've seen on the entire show is that the brother and sister bond between the Loudermilks, which kind of goes beyond any brother and sister, of course.
Right.
And basically the sacrifice that is made here, because what Carrie does, he ends up absorbing, talk about being empathetic.
Exactly.
I mean, that's taken to the ultimate extreme of an empath, where he actually literally takes on the injuries and the pain that his sister had suffered through, so that she would be able to, you know, So in a sense, that heals her so that she's able to fight on, even though the level of her injuries, I mean, Christ, they put him in a wheelchair, you know? Yeah. And I also love the fact that, you know, we got a wheelchair in here somewhere. It's like, oh, anyway. Well, he was bald. although that's like the biggest, fattest black guy I've seen ever, like in live action. It was almost cartoonish the way they did that thing. But there was something very kind of moving about it, actually. And there were actually a number of little moments in the episode. I mean, I won't go as far as to say they made me cry. That did not happen, but they kind of struck a little note with me. And a lot of them were the little conversations between Jermaine Clement, as you know, the father figure, talking to Sydney, and all the little conversations they have were kind of touching, you know. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of beautiful in their simplicity about wanting to keep her safe and her not being ready, but they're just written and then portrayed in such a nice little way. It was very kind of moving and very different from what we've seen from the Oliver character before that.
The word I wrote, and you know, this is an episode I didn't take many notes on, but the word I wrote to describe how I felt in their relationship and between all three of them was endearing. Like, it was very endearing to see them. It wasn't, you know, over the top melodramatic, but it was very sweet in a very understated way, sitting, talking at the table. You know, and there was almost, I mean, this is, you know, I'm going to date myself. So I apologize if you were born after 1985 and you're listening to this podcast, but there was almost like a little House on the Prairie feel that, like, hey, I'm going to go to town and get our daughter back. And it was played that earnestly, but not cheesy and melodramatic the way Little House on the Prairie was. But, it was very direct. And then of course, you know, you go from that, this pastoral earnest setting, to this just classic Legion left turn into absurdity that either you find delightful or it, you know, is the reason you don't watch the show. But I think, you know, I think probably you and I find it for the most part delightful because we're still watching.
Well, they do a couple things leading up to that are, you know, well, the from the very outset, we're going a left turn just for the whole fairy tale thing to begin with,
right?
Where and you know the humor of them referring to each other as husband and wife the whole time as well, which is kind of funny. And then when we pull back and we're like, oh, they're in a flower box on a fire escape mm-hmm. somewhere. Okay, you know, it's kind of like a version of like the snow globe concept or something. And all of a sudden we shift from this again, yeah, like, you know, this into the woods kind of thing, and next thing you know, it's like, you know, 19th century New York or something like that. It's like, okay, what? That's kind of a switch, all right. And then, yeah, then we go from that to rap battle. I was expecting to see like Method Man show up, you know, as the as the MC there. I would say it was probably, and having watched that show a bunch of times, and many of the contestants on that show, celebrities, not being people of color, even without that, oh my God, that was the whitest rap battle I've ever seen.
it was very much so, and I don't think there was any attempt to downplay that whatsoever.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was done for effect.
And I say it with the acknowledgement, yes, I know Jason Mantzoukas is not obviously white, you know, but you know, what is he actually? I guess he's some sort of Middle Eastern derivation. It doesn't matter. But they weren't like, yeah. I mean, like the rhyming meter was off from time to time. They're trying to squeeze in words, you know, whatever. It didn't matter. It was just the absurdity of it was enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Very much. Very much so.
Much like the dance numbers that we've talked about in the past. I don't know if I would rank this higher than some of those. I might rank it higher just in terms of absurdity, because it's like, okay, I didn't that first half hour of this episode, I didn't see it leading up to a rap battle. That hadn't been spoiled for me ahead of time, thankfully. So that was like, what is happening now?
And I think that that sentence that you just said encapsulates what this show is, in that all of the things we could envision that are possible and that they've done that have, you know, made us go, whoa, like, that's an interesting choice. You still have an episode where at the end you go, did that just happen? And they do it both with bold choices and with just sort of absurdist choices, like the rap battle.
Yep.
And by the time it's over, I mean, as it's happening, by the time it's over, like, I'm not sure how I feel about it, because I was completely unprepared for it. And I find that enjoyable, even if later I reflect back on it and don't love it. And I will say that the Mandzukas character of the wolf in the city, I like. The Mandzukas character in the woods is the one that more bothered me.
Yeah, I can see that. Although, yeah. I like them referring to each other by their first names.
Yeah.
There was something very cartoon-like about that. It reminded me of, like, you know, the old the sheepdog and the coyote, Wile E. Coyote cartoons, when it wasn't really Wile E. Coyote. They called each other, like, you know, Bill and Sherm or something. That wasn't what they would call each other, and they would, like, check in, and they'd, you know, whatever. I thought, you know, one of them, I think, like, the wolf is actually, the name is, like, Jerome.
Right.
And I don't remember what, I don't think Oliver's name is actually Oliver in it, but maybe it is. I don't remember. Anyway.
But it was enjoyable. And then we're jolted back to the present. And I have to be honest, the placement of the title sequence then made me wonder, like, I was like, is this like a double episode? did I not know, like, this is going to run long? And then it pops back into a completely jarring short scene that stops abruptly in a way that I know I read one thing, and I'm like you, I try to avoid reading as much as possible so that it doesn't filter through my head. And the one thing I read about it said that the jump into the present was jarring, and the person didn't know how, like, that made them feel. I sort of liked it, because if you're going to take an aside, a lot of people complain that you've just sort of jumped off the track and you didn't touch in with those characters,
mm-hmm.
like the famous Land Across the Sea or, you know, Lost episode, that something's happening and you don't even, you just totally go down this other track and we don't see the main characters. They jump right back into it and put the stakes back in, and the tension plus the sweet moment between the Carries, and jump you back in, that I thought was a nice ending to the episode. I think if they hadn't done that, it might have been more disappointing. I'm not sure, but yeah. I like that they did that.
I agree. I think in a way it was kind of done almost for along the lines of what you were saying, so there wouldn't be that, oh, did you just waste our time, kind of a feeling. Because even you can admire the audacity, which the show is all about being audacious, quite frankly, the audacious nature of doing something like this, but then there's also the, you've only got a few episodes left. Should you be spending time with this? Even though I guess every season has to have one Sid-centric episode. Because there was one in the first season, there was one in the second season, and that's how we look at the one for this one. Thing I find interesting with this episode, beyond everything that we've spoken about, both story and style or substance, is it firmly although I think we kind of knew this already, but it really firmly positions Sid as the hero now.
Mm-hmm.
And so if David has, not if, since David no longer is the hero of the story, and maybe he never was, but now we say, yeah, but Sid is. Sid is the one who's going to save the world and whatever, not, and save the world from David, quite frankly.
So, right.
Very curious how the show is going to end. I'm very... we're going to keep talking about it until it actually happens, and either our expectations are subverted or not because of what Hawley tends to do. And he likes to screw with us just a little bit, or maybe not so much. I spend a half an hour trying to explain away, you know, I don't want to spoil, if people haven't seen Fargo season two, there's a specific aspect to that season, which you either buy into and embrace, or you're like, what the hell are you doing? And mm-hmm. you know what I'm talking about. I'm sorry. And person just finished watching season two, and I watched a lot of it with her, and that was kind of a sticking point, and I kind of had to defend it, which I never had to before, because I think I just kind of accepted it, and was like, I went along with it. You know, it was hinted along there. But the person brought up some valid points about it, and I was still like, yeah, but you got to realize it's sometimes things are there that don't require or shouldn't be overly explained. And I think he does that. And if he does that with Fargo, he certainly does that with Legion. You know, it's amazing that we've gotten what little backstory we have gotten on some of these characters, quite frankly.
I totally agree with that. And I think that at some point, if you're going to buy in to, if you like the storytelling of Noah Hawley, at some point you have to divorce yourself from the idea that you're going to, you know, sort of expect documentary level realism, that it's going to be absurdist. It's going to be hyper psychedelic at times. I mean, obviously this season. And I think that that's part of the joy of the show is that in both subverting expectations and going on left turns, that you don't know what to expect. And in order for you to have that journey, sometimes it has to be so ridiculous that you either find it that you love it or it just doesn't work. But to take those chances is the only way to keep you on your toes in his universe.
Yeah.
And he makes big, I mean, he goes for it. He's like the Nicolas Cage of making like story choices. like he goes big.
Lord.
I mean, you know, like
Nicolas
Cage. Like, you know, if you think back to Fargo and the thing you're sort of alluding to and the idea of what happens at the hotel mm-hmm. at one point, like that's a big choice in the middle of that story. And there are big choices. And I think we go along to see what those big choices are, because sometimes they're just insanely fun to watch and experience. And so I feel like after the end of this episode, I'm confident in saying this now, and I've sort of alluded to it before, but we're in this season enough that I think after last season, I think Hawley completely has his mojo back with this show. And I don't regret watching it. And I hope people come to find it later if they're not watching it now, because I really enjoy the chances and the storytelling he's doing.
Yeah, I agree. This has been, it's been more fun to watch this season. Maybe because it's, he seems to have found a weird way of combining a very honed down, streamlined story while still being able to add on and pack on all the Noah Hawley gilding the lily touches that I think we really enjoyed in season one and we found to be a bit much in season two.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, giant pig thing aside, because I still never needed that thing. It just like, to me, it was just like a revolting thing to have to see in the frame every once in a while. Like, never served a purpose, so it bothers me. And if someone tells me what it meant, like, I don't care. Didn't need it. That aside, I've very much enjoyed this season. I mean, are there things that, you know, do I wish maybe they would spend more time with this or that or certain characters? Maybe a little bit, but it's not egregious. It's not, you know. And I think at a certain point I had also, just to be truly honest, having done a rewatch of season one and part of season two and just kind of reevaluating, I still love season one, don't get me wrong. But I also kind of like gotta have to see the show for what it is. And a lot of the joy of watching the show is just how the show is put together, and it's kind of just a treat for the eyes and ears, and it's kind of a very different spin on what is actually still the superhero genre than we are accustomed to. There's a few things like that in existence. This is one of them. It doesn't mean it's a show that's at the heights of, you know, storytelling or writing the way, say, you know, like a Breaking Bad is or something like that. Because it just doesn't have that kind of, it just doesn't have that depth of character to it. But that's not the story he's trying to tell. That's not what he's trying to do. And maybe he's trying to tell, maybe he's actually trying to tell a bigger story. So it's not less about backstories of characters and character development than trying to tell just a bigger story about humanity or good and evil or whatever, however you want to look at it. But like you said, he's a guy who clearly swings for the fences. And you know what? He might not be the batting leader, but he's probably going to connect more often than not. So,
right.
And I'm always going to be there to watch it. So, absolutely.
Right. And being a Yankees fan, you like those guys that swing for the fences. You know this. So.
Hey, DJ LeMahieu, man. LeMahieu. Gio Urshela.
I totally love, I have to say, like, I've loved this season, and I didn't want to love it until I was sure. And at the conclusion of last night's episode, I think there's enough of a track record this season that I'm on the train. I look forward to it because I don't know what's going to happen. I've got my investment in the characters, and I really hope that the carry into the void. And, you know, in some respects too, I want to know what the deal is with Switch. I want to get a resolution of that. That character is interesting to me. Not as much as our main characters. But I want to see what happens, and I'm on the train to see where it goes, and I've really enjoyed it, and I'm glad we've been able to stick with it, and it's been rewarding. I liken the way you were describing it a minute ago. I liken this to Holly's take is almost like the independent film version of a superhero story, where it's more perhaps for the eye and more for the artistic view of painting pictures and subverting things that a traditional story would tell. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, I think it's been very rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Holly definitely channels other creators in his work. I mean, you can obviously the Coen brothers in the Fargo stuff, but that's deliberate, you know, not just the show movie Fargo, but several of their movies. And mm-hmm. with Legion, I mean, there are times like, oh, what if David Lynch did a superhero story? That's what Legion would be, but with a budget that David Lynch isn't used to having. You know?
Right. I just imagine if you were an executive at FX and you watched some of these episodes, like, kudos to FX for letting this stuff be on, because I can't imagine a lot of networks that would put the money out and put this on TV.
No, I agree. Yeah, this is something that maybe I could see having existed maybe on, I don't know, Sundance maybe, but then mm-hmm. the show cost too much money for something like Sundance.
Right.
So at least I assume it certainly looks like it cost too much money. Yeah, it's funny because I watch the show and I kind of forget half the time that this is, you know, based on a Marvel comic character or characters. It's part of the, and technically it's part of the X-Men universe, whatever. And until you get the little hints or the actual references to his dad, I kind of forget about that, because there's only with all the different comic book related shows that are now everywhere. You got from your CW shows to all the different streaming services have things going on now, and everything from The Boys to Krypton. Obviously, this is probably the most out there and interesting one of them all. By the way, Krypton, surprisingly good. I'm just going to giving it a shout out in the podcast. If you like Superman, watch Krypton. It's season. Wow, really good. Anyway, it's everything Gotham should have been. Back to Legion. I kind of would like to have podcasted, but it's actually really fucking good.
I've watched season one, have not watched season two yet.
Two is better. Just the way they do Brainiac alone is amazing. But then they bring in Lobo and Zod and freaking Doomsday. All they need is a mix-up luck, and then you know. All right, but we're talking about Legion. Sorry. So we got two more to go, right?
Yep, two to go.
Two to go. And I have no idea if either of them are going to be extra long or not. I mean, this episode was actually, I think, ran about 10 minutes longer. I think this is like a 70-minute episode. So, with commercials, I mean. So, I'm assuming one or both of the last two will be a little bit longer than usual as well. I don't think they're going to go any two-hour episodes or anything like that. But I'm suspecting they'll go a little bit over. So.
Yeah, I would say so, and I guess the last question I'll leave you with: do you expect the fight to end next week and then sort of have a epilogue the final week?
Yeah, I could see them doing that. I kind of hope they don't. I know that's happened before, and Hawley's done that in his work as well. I don't want to spend an episode feeling like it's an epilogue more than an actual episode, you know.
I agree.
It just takes a little bit of the excitement out of it for me. Like even when I was watching, you know, the previously aforementioned season two of Fargo, there's part of me that always thinks, and I like the last episode of season two is fine. It's good. It's very good. But they kind of shoot their load in the episode before it. It's the Game of Thrones, you know, phenomenon, where right. The next to last episode was always the big one, and then the last one's like, eh. I hope they don't. I didn't really even watch the trailer or scenes from the next episode. I'm assuming it's just a lot of crazy shit's going to go on.
I purposefully skipped it because last week I found out I'd seen Jemaine Clement. So that's last week. I think at the end I mentioned that I expected them back because I'd seen them. And since I caught that last week, I intentionally avoided watching this week's next on to see what would, because I don't want to know in the event it will be that. I will say this, there are two things I don't want. What I don't want for this story is I don't want there to be a time travel ending where none of it happened and we go back to a point that there's not a reset of the beginning of Sid and David, but a reset to where David and Sid never meet and they each can live a different life. I don't want something that uncomplicates what has been necessarily complicated by the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want that. And I don't want episode 9 being here's what we do with David and episode 10 being the aftermath of what we do with David. Those are the two endings I don't want. Other than that, I really don't care what the ending is.
Does he die?
I would say if the definition of die is to not exist, to not exist in a plane where he can hurt people, then the answer to that question is yes.
Okay. Do you think we'll see anything that connects to that episode where we see all the multiple versions and possibilities of David? Oh, I always think about that one. I always wonder if that'll ever somehow come to pass. I know it won't, but...
I think there will be some sort of quantum physics version of David we'll see, the question will be, what is that David? And I don't think that David, the David we see and we see in any of those iterations, is basically, as was said in one earlier episode, he's basically the unchecked, like, atomic bomb that could go off. And based on what Sid's seen and known, I don't think that can be allowed to happen. And even if that's to take him inside of herself and, you know, sacrifice herself.
Right.
So that's an emotional toll. I'm not sure how I'll feel about, but I'm ready to see. But I don't want to erase all the bad that he's done and put it back to square one. And I think that would really cheapen the story if they do that.
Yeah, I could see there being an element of time that changes things, but I don't think it would although maybe his desire would be to undo that, I don't think that would actually end up being what happens. I think it would almost be, and we'll see, maybe end up being a more darker twist on it that he didn't see coming or something. Would be my anticipation. Because it would send the wrong message. It would just...
Exactly.
It would just be... No. And they pretty much have already said that in the series already. So it would be wrong. Okay. With that said, speaking of wrong, speaking of not having a segue whatsoever, if you enjoyed this podcast, that's not wrong. So it wouldn't be wrong of you to check out our Facebook page. It's a Serious TV Drama podcast page. You can like the page, join the page, and talk about shows like Legion, like The Boys, which I still haven't gotten the chance to watch yet, and a bunch of other things. You can also track us down on iTunes, Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us there. Heck, if you just Google Serious TV Drama Podcast, you can find us everywhere from YouTube to all these weird little services. I don't know what the hell they are. I don't know. But apparently they all add up to, we maybe have like 5 or 6 more listeners than I think we do. I don't know. And finally, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast, STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. We tweet out the links to the podcast and as well as the occasional, usually TV-related tweet. Like, for example, I believe that Twitter account sent out a tweet today about it being the series finale of iZombie was on tonight. Hopefully one or two of you out there watch that. Don't know. If you like Veronica Mars, you should be watching iZombie. If you're not, that's on you. Anyway, and that is all for this week. We will be returning next week with the penultimate podcast about Legion.
Penultimate.
And I was talking to Brian shortly before we started recording, I am trying to figure out how we may be able to do a podcast about the second season of Dark. So I'm leery about guaranteeing it the way I have been, but it's probably going to happen. We just have to talk between the two of us as well as Dan. Yay, Dan's going to return to the podcast, believe it or not. We'll actually have real music and real production value. And Jamie, of course. I think Jamie has been leading the charge about wanting to do a podcast about Dark. She's actually twisting my arm to make me to see if I'll do the podcast about the final season of Man in the High Castle. Maybe. Probably. Because if I say no, there's nothing on for Better Call Saul and Fargo or until next year. We'll have to shut our doors for 6 months or something. Anyway, with that said, Brian, once again, thank you for joining us. The singular us.
Remember, Scott, it's not you and us. It's, or you or us. It's you and us. So.
Oh my God, I'm so tired. Where's the music? Where the hell is that damn cheap, crappy musical thing? I wish I could find a music box that played the same tune. I just wind it up and play that instead. Here we go. So anyway, with that said, and always remember, What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. Good night, everybody, and don't forget chlamydia.
Good night, everyone.